Good morning and welcome to Medicine on Call. I have a very special guest today with me who's been on the show before, Dr. Jane Orion of the American Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And I wanted to have her on because I think we're at a really important juncture in our society, especially from a medical perspective. Yesterday, we were told by the CDC that a patient entered the United States with active Ebola, and this changes the game, in my opinion. We've been told that we shouldn't worry, it'll never come to the United States. We've been told a lot of things as if they were absolutes. And I think it's now time to have an unfiltered conversation about what we really can expect, what our risks are, and how we can actually start to protect ourselves. Dr. Orion, I saw you on Newsmax a couple of weeks ago, I guess it was, that you appeared, and you spoke eloquently about the Ebola virus, and you talked about things that people don't talk about. I understand we don't want to alarm people, but there's a difference between alarming people and informing them. And if people don't know what to expect, then they really can't do anything to protect themselves. So I wanted to get your take on, I know that you didn't see the press conference yesterday, but some of the things that were said, I'd love to get your take on. One of the things that was said is that we're at no risk as Americans from this patient traveling from Liberia to the United States. And the first thing they said, that the people on the plane were not at risk. What's your take on that?
I think the answer is that we really don't know. There are all kinds of things about Ebola virus that we really don't know. There have been outbreaks in Africa before that were controlled and that burned out pretty easily. They were nothing like the current outbreak, which is occurring in densely populated areas. And the situation there is totally out of control. The people there are dealing with a desperate situation. It's chaotic. But the information that we have about the transmissibility of this disease comes from the clinical experience in Africa. And they don't have the sophisticated diagnostic facilities. They are dealing with desperately sick patients. They are not getting the kind of records and epidemiological information that we need to have. So we don't really have any basis for saying that you can't get this during the incubation period.
Exactly. That was my take on it as well. And the statement, one of the doctors came on TV last night and said that there is no way that this virus is stable. This has been the same virus since it first began the outbreak in the, I guess it was the 70s when it first appeared, and that we have no reason to worry that it will mutate.
This is just not true. I mean, there have been many variants of the Ebola virus. And the one that we have now seems to be more virulent than some of the others. But yeah, there have been variants that have been isolated, and it's an RNA virus. It's the type of virus that mutates very rapidly because there are frequent transcription errors as it replicates. Mm-hmm. And we have no reason for being confident that we're not going to see even more virulent mutants.
I think one of the things I've noticed about the media presentation of this is that they keep saying as if it's absolute. It can never happen. No need to worry. There's no gray area. As soon as I hear that, a flag goes up in me that what they're saying can't possibly be true because they can't predict things that they don't know about. And I think people maybe need to listen to things and be more critical about critical thinking about what's said to them. Is that a reasonable way to filter what's going on with, or unfilter what's going on with what's being said?
Well, this is just basic. There are no absolutes in medicine. And we have a rapidly developing and changing situation now, and the source of confidence in public health authorities that everything will be just fine is just no basis in fact, in my opinion.
Let's talk about the virus itself for a second. This is, it's a cousin, is it not, of the Marburg virus?
Yes, they're both members of the filovirus family, phylo meaning filament or thread, and it's just because of the appearance of an electron microscopy.
And the Marburg virus, is it also a hemorrhagic fever, or is it
yes,
present
yes.
differently?
Yeah, there are a number of hemorrhagic fevers, and they all present a little bit differently. But, the Ebola virus is just highly fatal. In fact, people who really think humanity is a plague upon the planet have spoken of Ebola virus as an excellent way to get rid of 90% of the human population. We know that there have been efforts to weaponize it, to use it in biological weapons, because these are much cheaper, and if people are interested in wreaking mass destruction and they can't afford or don't have the technical capacity to produce nuclear weapons, well, biological weapons are even more lethal and very, very cheap.
That's a sobering thought. And the fact that this is so lethal, my first take on the government's approach to this was it was very laissez-faire. It was, this can never happen here, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here, move along. And they were, we're letting flights continue to travel from these countries all over the world. I think British Airways may be one of the first airlines to stop travel, specifically from Liberia. But we're having students who are exchange students come over to the country for this academic year, and the only thing they did is check to see if they had a temperature. I mean, there's all sort of things that just seem to be, I don't understand. This is a virus that requires someone to be in a biohazard 4 or bio-level 4 containment because it is so virulent and toxic. And we're just saying, hey, no problem. You can just travel as you like, be next to the person. Is that logical, in your opinion, or are we being sold a bill of goods there?
Well, it's not logical. If you look at the CDC personnel, when they are dealing with it and how they are outfitted, head to toe, impermeable garments, respirators, and very elaborate precautions for donning and removing this apparel, they're certainly not acting as though they believe what they're telling us.
Exactly. And now we have potentially 3,000 American troops being sent to Liberia.
Including mothers of young children. The mothers of one of the children at our school is being deployed, has been deployed to Africa.
Wow.
Do we expect these troops ever to come home?
How are we even going to set them up?
Well, I guess they're carrying little packets of alcohol-based disinfectants for hand sanitizing. Do we know that this kills the virus? We're told that it doesn't kill the norovirus, which is a gastrointestinal virus. Do we know whether it kills Ebola? Or do you need to use bleach? The CDC says, wash your hands with soap and water. How are you, as a soldier in the field, going to wash your hands with soap and water every time you touch something that might be contaminated?
Plus, I mean, if you're using an alcohol-based wash, how permeable does your skin become from the alcohol itself?
Well, this I don't know, but I don't know how permeable your skin has to be. There are receptors for the Ebola virus in the skin, and the infective dose is said to be extremely low, maybe fewer than 5 to 10 particles on average have to touch you before you can become infected.
Interesting. So this is the question I definitely hope that you can answer, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. We've been told that that you have to show active symptoms in order to infect somebody with the Ebola virus. I've never heard of that work with any other virus that we've come in contact with. With the flu virus, you can pass it without being sick. With HIV, you can pass it without showing symptoms. We know this is in bodily secretions. Is that reasonable for them to say something like that?
I cannot imagine how a person could in good conscience say that, because, as you say, it would be pretty unprecedented for a virus not to be transmissible during the incubation period. Like, before you get the symptoms, you probably have a viremia with the virus in your blood. Certainly, as soon as you get a skin rash, as frequently happens with Ebola, that means that the virus is in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be transmitted from your skin and from sweat, from saliva, from tears. And they say it's not airborne. Well, I'm not sure what they mean by that, because, like, even TB, you say it's airborne. Well, it's not like a gas molecule. It's in the air on some kind of particle or droplet, something like that.
Well, there's a study from Canada pretty recently, within the last few years, that show that there was airborne transmission between pigs and monkeys who were held in captivity, who were not in the same cage but were next to each other, so their air would be shared. And the Ebola virus is passed, at least in animal studies. So again, absolutes of it could never happen, I think, are a little disingenuous.
Well, the receptors in the mucous membranes, and virus has been found in the airways and lungs of at least some of the animals that have been dissected. I mean, Canadian public health is being more honest with its people, I think, and said we really can't be sure that there's not airborne transmission, which means that if you're on an airplane where the air is recirculated and they're not using HEPA filters, I don't believe they are, you could be getting Ebola or tuberculosis or all kinds of other things if there's an infected person on the plane.
This is just unconscionable. I mean, this is about public health and simple things that they could have done or could be doing to protect us just don't seem to be in place. And I know that there's an executive order that's been signed that if the government is allowed to detain anybody with a respiratory illness, doesn't have to be diagnosed as Ebola, you just have to be, you know, presumed to be ill, and you will be quarantined, and it could be indefinitely.
Well, and you could be put in a quarantine facility with other people who are sick. So if you're not sick with Ebola to begin with, you may get it from the quarantine facility. And it's just, if it's a public health threat and you've got one patient with Ebola, that is a manageable problem. But if that person has infected even two others, then exponentially your containment becomes very quickly out of control.
I know we're coming up on a break, but I just want you to think about this and then answer it after the break's over. But they're saying that they can loosely follow the people that this person has been in contact with. They're not talking about quarantining them. They're talking about following them for the next 21 days. That implies to me that they're going to go about their business, still interact with other people, wait till they get sick, and then you're at the same position where now you have to look at their contacts. And it's just not aggressive enough to try to get this thing under control. Don't answer yet, but on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that snoring can lead to chronic health problems? Snoring can be a sign of sleep apnea. Snoring is simply noisy breathing that can disturb those around you. However, sleep apnea is a serious condition that leads to a decrease in oxygen in the blood. The brain and the heart are two organs that depend on oxygen to function well. Studies have shown that a lack of oxygen at night leads to weight gain, problems with memory and concentration, depression, high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, and stroke. There are several ways to decrease snoring. For example, lose weight if you are overweight. Avoid alcohol at least 3 to 4 hours before bedtime. Stop smoking. Control nasal allergies to things such as dust and mold. And avoid eating dairy products such as milk and cheese. If you think you have sleep apnea, you should see a doctor to be evaluated. Please join me on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're having a frank discussion about our Ebola threat here in the United States with Dr. Jane Orient. Prior to the break, I was asking Dr. Orient about whether she believes that this CDC epidemiological study, if you want to put it that way, of this patient one in the United States, the fact that they're following his contacts, they didn't even mention talking to the people on the plane or the people who might have come in contact with him and all these transfers from the different airports on his way into the United States. It's appeared to me that they're not even checking to that level of exposure, just the most recent contacts in the last 4 days of when he was actually infected. Is that strong enough containment, or is that really just window dressing?
I think that the risk that people caught it from him while he was walking through the airport or sitting on the airplane, if he really wasn't coughing or sneezing, is really quite low, but not zero. But what is most disturbing is that he presented himself to the emergency room several days before he was admitted and was sent home. So have they notified everyone who took care of him in the emergency room, or the other patients who were there, or his family, or the people who he was visiting, or the contacts during those days after he was in the emergency room and before he was admitted to the hospital? Those people are at much higher risk than the ones on the airplane. What's being done about them?
Good question. And again, it brings up the question mark in my mind when we're told we have the best healthcare system that's ready for action, knows what to do if the Ebola patient comes into their hospital setting. That's an example of them not knowing what to do.
No, they sent him home. The first time, did they get a travel history on him? Did they get us to where he came from? Apparently not. You know, and our public health system is not nearly as robust as they would like you to believe. They're overstressed if they have half a dozen cases of measles or pertussis.
Good question. And now you have this respiratory virus that's been inundating the hospitals. I'm just struck by the fact that the first part of taking an intake is a history, and you would have known from the beginning that this patient should have been admitted and isolated immediately had someone really been following standard of care. Now, we've had a long conversation in the past on our show about the state of our hospitals. This is an example of where we stand when you don't have people who know what's going on the front line. Chances of him having an intake by a doctor on that initial visit, I question that. I wonder if it was a PA or a nurse practitioner or somebody who really was just following along, you know, doing what a standard of what they were told would be and not thinking outside the box.
Well, I think it is recommended at this point, if you have any patient who has headache or fever or muscle aches and so on, you need to get a travel history and a contact history. That needs to be done now. It should have been done in Dallas at a big hospital emergency room, and apparently wasn't. But I think doctors all over the country need to be aware of this at this point.
You know, I haven't had any contact from the CDC or any official contact as a physician about what to expect and how to follow a protocol so that I can get a suspected patient into the system. And I live in Atlanta, so the CDC is, you know, it's a big player for us. We've got no information. Have you received any?
No, I haven't. And yet I do get information about measles or pertussis. If there were a case of that somewhere, I would have gotten notice about it. And, you know, with these people, these children who were being admitted across the country for this very serious respiratory virus, which, by the way, is a relative of the polio virus, and some of these children are becoming paralyzed, and the paralysis is not getting better. We're being reassured by saying, well, nobody has died yet, but last I heard there was still a child who was on cardiopulmonary bypass because he couldn't oxygenate his blood. If this were measles, we would know the index case. And we would know what the contact history was. But this question, if this question is being asked, then the people who know the answer are not telling us.
That's a really good point. And, you know, they said initially that this enterovirus was a D68, is an old virus, hasn't been seen for many years, and, you know, so that we don't really know or have a facility of how this is going to play out. I mean, is that reasonable for them to say something like, I mean, this is now we have to question everything that we're being told by the public health system because they keep withholding information.
Well, the obvious question is, where is this coming from? It is rare here at this point, which means we have no immunity to it. But it's not rare every place in the world. For example, I've heard it's not rare in Central America. And we have had tens of thousands of children from Central America sent by charter flights to public schools all over the country. Is that the source of the virus? And if it is, why do we keep doing that? Or why do we say, okay, you have these children from Central America, maybe we should keep them out of school for a while?
Exactly. Or do health checks on them, because ultimately a majority of the children who've entered and adults who've entered our country have not been physically examined by a physician, because the volume is so overwhelming, they didn't have enough manpower to do it.
And plus, they may not be very sick, because if they come from an endemic area, they may be somewhat immune to it.
That's true. So, they, again, you're asymptomatic. You're not showing a symptom, but you can literally pass it along into a community that you enter. And we're talking about children and adults who've never seen this. And thus, the weakest immune system in our society are the seniors and the young children. And that's, you know, the young children are now being affected, which is pretty, if that's the source, then the government really needs to take a step and look back at what it's doing instead of playing politics. But they need to really start thinking about the health of our population.
Well, you can call the children refugees or whatever you like, but there's a way of dealing with refugees. You do not put them on a secret charter flight in the middle of the night. The public health department either can't find out or won't tell who is on the plane, what screening has been done, where are they going, what's going to happen to them. Why does this have to be a secret operation? Our public health department promised to look into these charter flights that are coming from Brownsville, Texas to Tucson, Arizona, sometimes in the middle of the night. I mean, this is not a popular destination from Brownsville, Texas. And they're coming on like Casino Express and other charter airlines. And, this just makes absolutely no sense from the public health standpoint.
Do you know if it's still happening?
I haven't looked into it lately. You can trace flights on the internet. I just haven't looked at it recently.
That is shocking. I mean, I know that they were dropping people off at bus stations and they were putting them on commercial airlines without being TSA checked, and there have been people been scattered across the country, and ultimately, because of our laws here in the United States, these children must be educated, and so they're entering the school system. This is a direct pipeline, potentially, from an endemic area for these diseases into the public school system unchecked, with children who have never been, if you're into vaccinating, never been vaccinating against anything, and are sharing cups if they're small kids and touching each other. And this is a recipe for what we're seeing right now.
Well, if you've got one infected child in a public school class, everybody is probably going to be exposed. That's just the way children are. That is inevitable. And there's all this effort to make parents feel so guilty if they don't vaccinate their child. It'll be their child's fault if there's a measles outbreak, even though the child doesn't have measles. But what about all of these children who may have diseases for which there is no immunity, who are just being introduced in very large numbers without any capacity for monitoring them?
It's unconscionable, frankly. And you're talking now about the respiratory virus, but TB is another thing that's endemic to the Central American countries, and specifically the drug-resistant version of the tuberculosis. Have you heard that as well?
Well, virtually 100% of everyone in the United States who's been detected with having drug-resistant TB is foreign-born. And the majority of people with any type of TB are foreign-born. We had a case of somebody, a person, it didn't say whether it was a child or an adult, in an elementary school here in Tucson with TB. We weren't told whether it was drug resistant. It was a little article in the paper about how some effort was being taken. They were screening a bunch of people who were at that school. But we don't know where the person, the index case, came from, and whether there might be some other people who were in contact with that index case in other schools, in other cities.
You shouldn't even have to say something like that, because the whole point of the public health system is to know exactly what's going on everywhere in the country when it comes down to a communicable disease.
Well, they're screening, I understand, 1,000 people in Las Cruces, New Mexico, for TB. Because there have been cases in New Mexico, lots of them, that seem to be related to the influx of immigrants or illegal immigrants.
That hasn't been on TB at all. No one has spoken about that at all. This is another problem that I have. It's, you know, we have all of this media hype for George Clooney's wedding, but nothing when it comes down to, you know, immediate health risks. People should know that. And also the hospital in Texas where newborn children were exposed to a worker with tuberculosis, and now 4 of them have tested positive. And we don't know who that worker was. Were they, you know, was it a nurse? Was it someone who was cleaning the area? Were they documented? We have no idea.
No, and there has been a lot of discussion. If we have a person with active TB in Tucson, where do we hospitalize them? It's been said we have maybe 2 negative pressure isolation rooms in the whole city.
Wow.
That was a long time ago. I don't know what the situation is now, but as far as I know, they've not been building any more isolation rooms for tuberculosis. There may be isolation rooms for people who are having bone marrow transplants, but there the idea is to keep the germs out of the room, not to keep the germs out of the hospital.
On that note, let's take a break, because I want to discuss that statement that any hospital in the United States is ready for an Ebola patient to enter. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com.
Listen to America's Voice for Energy. I'm Marita Noon, and each week I'll guide our discussion on a fresh, news-based energy topic, only on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that an inability to lose weight can be due to an underactive thyroid gland? The thyroid gland is an important organ that controls the metabolism. Signs of an underactive thyroid gland include depression, hair loss, weight gain, a low blood pressure, feeling cold, constipation, and a lower libido. Risks for low thyroid function include iron deficiency, liver dysfunction, family history of thyroid disease, and an irregularity in the immune system. If you have noticed any of these symptoms, or you have noticed swelling in the front of your neck, or the color of your shirt feels tight, you should see your doctor for further evaluation, including blood tests, to evaluate the levels of thyroid hormone in your bloodstream. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to The Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're having an important conversation about the Ebola virus with Dr. Jane Orient, who is somebody that I truly respect and admire, who understands and is really what a doctor should be, a patient advocate who's not afraid to speak her mind and tell the truth. And that's what we're talking about today, the truth about what we're being told. Is it really window dressing just to, you know, make us stand down, make us, you know, put more of our faith in government entities and also into the public health system that's supposed to protect us? Or should we really be taking a look at this critically and really thinking about what they're saying? If you have a little voice that tells you that doesn't quite make sense, you need to start listening to it. So the most recent thing, or the next piece of this argument they're trying to construct for us to just, you know, let them do what they want to us, is that every hospital in this country is set up to take care of an Ebola patient. Now, initially, if that were the case, why did the person have to come to Emory, which is part of the CDC? He could have gone to his own private health system in, I think it's from Pennsylvania, or I think it's North Carolina, but it wasn't Georgia. And we're having people go to specific hospitals initially, the healthcare workers, but now all of a sudden this Texas hospital is able to take care of the person when they can't even diagnose the person initially when they come in. Is that true, in your opinion, that any hospital is able to take care of an Ebola patient as long as they have an isolation unit?
I don't think even Emory was prepared to take care of the patient. What they had, the waste management workers complaining, saying we're not equipped to handle the soiled linens or the other hazardous waste. We need to be trained specially to do that. So if you can't even get rid of your soiled linens or your other biological waste, can you say that you are prepared? And how many impermeable suits do you have to for your personnel to wear? I mean, how many disposable things do you have? Do you have enough gloves? Do you have enough face shields? Do you have any respirators? Do you have N95 masks or HEPA masks? Or are you just relying on surgical masks, which are not very effective? I think the hospitals need to do their inventory, and I think if they seriously tried to beef up their supplies, they would find that they weren't available. I mean, you can't even get intravenous fluids in adequate supplies, and that's the main thing we will need for treating Ebola victims, because keeping them hydrated is one of the few things that we can do for them.
That's exactly right. And what people need to understand, it's about supportive care. It's about making sure that you keep up with their fluid loss, that you balance their electrolytes. It's not the ZMAP and other things that necessarily are things that are saving people. It's the fact that we can support them and keep up with it, as opposed to a field hospital in West Africa where their supplies are even more depleted than it's tragic, actually, what's going on there.
I mean, do we even have the capacity to run the blood test to check their electrolytes safely in the laboratory? Will our lab technicians refuse to do the tests or refuse to draw the blood, as has happened already, and an anesthesiologist had to do the blood draw?
See, these are things we don't know. These are things that it makes it sound like it's just a bubble and everything is working like clockwork and nothing to worry about. But it takes one of those people along that chain to break protocol or to have a lab accident, and then it's a whole different ballgame. Now, you know, I know we're backtracking a little bit, but to the aid workers, the doctors who were initially infected, my first take on it is maybe we should have kept them there, sent our personnel to Africa, set up a system, which we can, where they could have the same treatment there instead of bringing them back to the United States as the initial barrier to that virus entering our country. Do you think that would have been a reasonable thing to do?
Absolutely. I think it's the only sensible thing to do, and it probably would have been less expensive to send the hospital there than to bring the patient here, and then we'd have another hospital there to take care of other patients. Plus, I don't think we ever really found out how those doctors became infected, because maybe that would give us a little bit of epidemiology that we need to know.
Well, I think one that we know about is definitely a question mark, was the OBGYN doctor who got infected while delivering a baby or doing a GYN procedure on a patient in Liberia who was not symptomatic, who did not have Ebola. That, to me, was the first question mark that there's no one ever answered that. It wasn't, the patient wasn't sick. He wasn't involved with fluids, technically, and he got it. So
that only takes one example to disprove this absolute statement that you can't get it from a person who's not symptomatic.
Exactly. And the fact they keep doubling down on the same statement, it's just, you know, I don't know how they look at themselves in the face. There's another example that's come through recently with a tanker or shipping, some sort of cargo ship, into New Orleans, where people were, they were sick, fell ill as soon as they entered the port, and they were sent to a New Orleans hospital. They're claiming it's malaria, but I'm not so sure. Somebody died from that same ship in Bermuda. So, are we really getting any stories here, or we're just being fed a narrative so that we don't get alarmed while this thing is coming into the country unchecked?
Well, panic is itself devastating, and we need to avoid panic. But if you need to have, people need to have confidence in the authorities. And if you can't believe anything the authorities tell you, then it's a setup for panic and for wild rumors and for all kinds of chaos.
You're absolutely right. And for me, the first line of defense is the truth. You know, you don't have to have people panic, but I think we need to now learn how to protect ourselves, and we need to understand what may be putting us at risk. I think those are first lines of defense, you know, that we can do. We don't need the government to help us, but to actually do things that are going to protect our immune system, things that will keep us out of harm's way, things that will keep this from becoming a problem in the country. Is that something that you tell your patients?
Oh, I think so. I think it's very important to emphasize that you exercise good common sense, that you are really meticulous about washing your hands. At some point, you might want to stay away from places where there's more of a risk of becoming infected. Certainly, if you are a physician or a nurse on the front lines, you need to take a travel and contact history on everyone and have a high index of suspicion. I mean, it's not altogether easy. It's not like you can just do a blood test at the local lab. There are very specialized tests for Ebola that have to be done, and I think you really have to get the public health authorities involved even to get the tests done. But if you don't ask the questions, then you're going to be sending the patient out to infect all kinds of other people, including the people they love the most.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we talked a bit about the border, but ultimately, that's another avenue that potentially people can come in unchecked, it's basically a pathway. And once these folks enter, you know, we're talking about multiple diseases. TB is one, Ebola is one. There's been other things like meningitis, bacterial pneumonia, all sorts of things that have been found in the holding areas of the people who are now waiting to come into the country. So,
which are very crowded and not very hygienic.
Yeah.
And the most distressing thing of all is that the Border Patrol or the contract medical personnel have been told that if they talk about illnesses, they will not only be fired, but they might be criminally prosecuted.
I've heard that too. And just the fact that that's the case means, as you said a minute ago, why are they hiding things from us? What's the purpose of that? And what do they stand to gain by doing that? I mean, this is a big picture. It's bigger than us in the sense. But if you're talking about people who potentially can cause health risks and harm that are irreversible in some cases to innocent members of our society, period. Is that worth winning at all costs? I mean, that's the question that I have to ask. I know that you are politically active. Are there people who are now meeting with Congress or congresspersons and saying, what are you doing and what's going on?
Well, I certainly hope so. But the Border Patrol will tell us that they only apprehend 3% of the people who are crossing, and of the people they do apprehend, they know they're coming not just from Mexico and Central America, but from 100 nations all over the world, including West Africa. Not all of them are people who are refugees or looking for a better life, if you put the best construction on it. Some of them are armed to the teeth. They're narco-terrorists. They're wearing gang insignia, and the Border Patrol is ordered to let them go.
It's criminal when you think about it. I mean,
and some of these people have admitted to already killing several people in Central America, and we are just letting them loose in American society.
And what's even worse, we're letting people out of our jails to be deported and then come right back into the country. So this is it's a criminal entity that's entering the society, straightforward criminal entity. And also, from a medical standpoint, people who are dangerous, maybe unbeknownst to them, but are.
You cannot make, I don't think you can make a humanitarian case for having a completely uncontrolled entry of our border. There is just, that's just not humane in any way.
So for those people who call, people who question racist or sexist or xenophobic, it's very simplistic, and I think it's bullying if you really want to distill it down. If you want your way no matter what, and anybody who questions it, you need to shut them up by any means necessary. And the most effective way that I've found to shut people up in our society right now is to label them as something, as someone who hates something. And that's totally ridiculous. It's time for us to stand up and speak about it, you know.
Well, and who is really hating? I mean, are you hating those little kids who are on respirators in Colorado or in Midwest or in countries or in states all across the Union? Do you hate those little asthmatics who can't breathe? And that's why you subjected them to a risk that you should have been able to foresee?
That's a good question. And I think if you say that, if you ever on a show with somebody who's a proponent, I think that would probably stop them in their tracks instead of them trying to shout people down and just silence opposition. Because this is about potentially a political windfall down the road. I mean, is that something that you think is driving this? I know it's not humanitarian because it's the way we just discussed. It can't be. But is this about politics as the end game?
I think it's about power and control. And guess what that means about politics? That the group that wants to tell the rest of us what to do seems to have supreme self-confidence that it's better than the rest of us. And as you say, it will shut us up by any means whatsoever. Name-calling is mild compared with what they possibly could do. I mean, they have actually threatened to put people in prison for speaking out about a public health risk.
That's tragic, and that's criminal in its sense, in itself. And, you know, let's extrapolate that now to the healthcare profession, because this is what's going on amongst the doctors in the healthcare industry at this point. If we do start speaking up for our patients being advocates for their health, we're not allowed to do that anymore. I mean, unless you're an independent physician, you actually have to toe the line of the system that you work for. If that's Medicare, if you're a doctor that takes Medicare or Medicaid, you can't really be an advocate for your patient anymore. If you're on a hospital staff, you have the threat of peer review to shut you down. I mean, I see this as an endemic problem within the healthcare system itself.
It is, and doctors are being made the scapegoats. It's going to be doctors' fault if this disease gets out of control, and yet if the doctors try to do what's right by their patients, their whole career could be ruined. It's such a privilege to practice medicine, such a privilege to invest $250,000 and 10 years of your life to try to serve your patients. But then if someone doesn't like something you said that you maybe stood up to the hospital administration or a patient got aggrieved for some reason or other, all that could be wasted, and you may not even be able to find a job stacking boxes in a warehouse.
People don't understand that. They don't see that. It's unfortunate that practicing medicine is like practicing in a war zone. You're under duress. Any choice you make, you have to think about the consequences of what can happen to you. And we talked about, and I'd love to revisit a little bit about maintenance of certification and peer review for listeners who don't know what that is. When we graduated, when we board certified, you and I, we don't have to retake our boards. It's as if a lawyer would be asked to take the bar over and over again about every 5 to 10 years. It's ridiculous. Once you certify, once you pass the qualifications, you should not have to re-up in order to practice your craft. And we're the only profession they're trying to do that to.
Well, and the people who are making you re-up, they probably don't practice very much medicine. The answers to the exam that you're supposed to learn may be outdated by the time they get on the exam, and yet they're posing as the protectors of society. There may be doctors out there who haven't kept up or who maybe have become demented, and we need to protect you from them. But these are the people who are earning millions of dollars from this scam, who have no evidence whatsoever that they're making anything better. And they're making doctors' lives miserable, driving some of them out of the profession when they still have maybe 10 or 20 years of excellent service in them, and just distracting doctors from doing the things that they need to do to stay at the top of their game.
Well said. On that note, let's take a small break. We're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know skipping doses of medication can be dangerous? If you have a chronic medical condition like diabetes or high blood pressure, it's important to take the medication prescribed by your physician. It is also important to remember that although you take a medicine to treat a condition, it is not a cure for the underlying medical condition. It is used to control it. For example, taking medication for diabetes will lower your blood sugar. However, if you stop taking the medication, the sugar will rise again. Changes in both diet and lifestyle, like adding exercise to your routine, are equally important. Working with your physician by following his or her recommendations is the key to controlling your disease and maintaining your health. Ask questions if you don't understand something. Taking control of your health is the key to wellness. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. I think that, you know, I get up and go to work every day, and I love what I do. And ultimately, I feel that if I want to continue to practice medicine and really practice it, not be a mouthpiece for an insurance industry or a government trying to limit access and price my patients out of their care, this is what it's about. It's about educating people with the help of people like Dr. Orient so that we can get the word out about what the truth is as opposed to what they deem it to be. This is amazing. I've never seen it. It's like doublespeak. It's 1984. I've had to reread all these books that I read as in high school because it's coming to pass, and it's so frustrating to live in an environment where the truth is in front of you and someone's telling you you're not seeing what you're seeing. And better yet, you should just go back to sleep and not pay any attention. We're in control. We got this. We can't afford to do that anymore, can we, as doctors or as patients?
We cannot. And it is so distressing that the people who should be speaking out on behalf of our profession are trying to squelch the truth, whether it's in their own self-interest or because they have this ideological conviction that things should be a certain way and that anybody who doesn't see it their way is somehow either a criminal or is just crazy. It's so hard to stand up against people who are supposed to be on our side and yet are not even paying us the respect of listening to us.
I mean, I don't know if this is I probably have to have a psychiatrist or psychologist on our show, because it just makes absolutely no sense to this groupthink that is going on. Last week I had a show about the vaccine, the MMR vaccine, and how one of the researchers admitted that they had fudged the results, and it turns out there is a connection between autism and the MMR vaccine, especially among black boys and males in general. And I went on one of the doctor websites and put a link to that, and I got the response back that, oh, it wasn't in the media, it wasn't carried, so it can't be a real story. Can you believe that?
I can believe it. It's getting hard to... there's so many things that are happening that would have been unbelievable 20 years ago. But I've seen emails from the CDC that we got in response to a Freedom of Information Act request showing there were people there who were knowledgeable about this rotavirus causing intussusception, which is a bowel problem in children who are receiving it, sometimes requiring surgery. And they were trying not to let that get out in the public. Ultimately, they had to withdraw the vaccine in this country, but they didn't withdraw it worldwide. So, and their own emails are so incriminating, and now they're really clamping down on FOIA requests and referring them to political appointees and having all kinds of pretexts for not letting the information get out.
That sounds like a conspiracy, doesn't it? It's a concerted effort to lie and hide the truth.
Well, you're nuts if you are a conspiracy theorist, but I don't know why it's applied only to one side of the issue. I think every time there's a criminal indictment, there's a conspiracy added to the charges so you can get more jail time.
Well, you know, maybe some of these people need to be visiting the jail. I mean, because they're hurting innocent children for monetary gain. I mean, as soon as they passed that law that vaccine manufacturers couldn't be sued, had to be held harmless or blameless, there was an explosion of vaccine produced. I didn't realize that the rotavirus vaccine was causing this kind of problem. I mean, the Gardasil vaccine is also, that's the one of the newer ones on the market, and that's killing children. That's really damaging girls, and it's never been fully tested.
Well, I guess it's being tested now on a very huge population, but we're not keeping the results in a form that people can use.
We're not, and the doctors who are fighting or having adverse reactions are saying that it's not a problem. I mean, they may not even be reporting them. So then this is not even, the whole system is just skewed.
So it can't be the vaccine. This girl was perfectly healthy and doing athletics before she got the vaccine, and now all of a sudden she can't walk. Must have been something else, a coincidence.
There you go. No critical thinking skills on our colleagues' part. And is this just the fact, well, let me ask this a different way. Are pediatricians, have you ever heard of pediatricians being under duress that if they start to question things like, is a vaccine safe? Should I give this schedule of vaccines to my patients? That they might have something adverse happen to them from their pediatric academy, their board. Is that happening at all, or is this just cheap?
Well, I know that the American Academy of Pediatrics is totally ideologically committed to the vaccine schedule without deviation, and that anyone who suggests that there might be a problem with that is incompetent or is a tool for the vast right-wing conspiracy or something like that, and that if physicians do not have an excellent vaccine compliance in their patients, they may suffer consequences from their HMO or from the other insurance panels that they're a member of, or they may be demeaned by their colleagues. So, there is a lot of pressure to conform.
Wow. I actually just found out that Medicare, because I'm no longer a provider, happily, but that Medicare now puts on their public database what the doctors do, how many people they see, what their coding habits are. And that same website that I went to, doctors were demeaning this one doctor because he was not giving enough vitamin B12 shots or he wasn't giving enough vaccines. It was incredible the amount of pressure that our own colleagues brought to bear on this one person because of what they could see his prescribing and his treatment habits were. That's really unacceptable.
Boy, that's even worse than I thought. I knew that many physicians were under duress because they were big billers and they were looked upon by the public as being just these unscrupulous fat cats, when in fact they were just providing very expensive drugs and maybe billing for the whole clinic.
Mm-hmm. It's always a half-truth when it comes to demonizing doctors, it seems. Or they have the sickest patients who require more care. None of that seems to come to pass. It's just that you're an outlier and you're a bad person. And now I see this evidence-based medicine and all these reportings that have to go into the electronic medical record system. I see them now in a different way that you just opened my eyes to. If you don't vaccinate there's always a question on these EMRs, vaccination schedule. I'm an ENT, so I don't vaccinate people. But if they're keeping that as data, and they're going to use it against you when it comes time to reapply for the insurance, or maybe reapply for your hospital privileges, or maybe reapply for your license. That can potentially be used against you to keep you in line.
Absolutely. And as part of these maintenance of certification things, they want to monitor your medical records, and you need to find an area in which you can improve, which may be, you know, you give more vaccines, or your diabetic's hemoglobin A1C is better, or their blood pressure is better. And it's, you know, extremely time-consuming, onerous. And if you have patients who maybe don't comply, or who, like, operate heavy equipment and you're afraid of making them hypoglycemic, then you either need to dry lab the results, you know, just fake it. You need to get rid of these patients from your practice, or you could suffer the consequence of just not being able to get MOC because you haven't improved.
And you know who's going to suffer from this? It'll be the sickest patients, because no one will want to take care of them. Because
maybe no one can take care of them, because it might be the end of their career if they do.
There you go. Or, and they don't want to put them in the hospitals because the hospitals have to readmit them within 30 days, so they won't be paid. This system is driving people into a palliative hospice situation, where someone who you could take care of if they really have optimal medical care are not going to get it because of cost, because of all of these regulations.
Well, hospice used to be for people with terminal cancer. Now it's for people who just are kind of expensive. And even for rather young people, they don't have a terminal disease. I know of one person who was put in the hospice and died after she was in her 50s. She had a hip replacement. She was in good enough shape to undergo the surgery. But in the rehab facility, somebody ran over her with a motorized wheelchair, and she got a fracture of the femur, and they put her in hospice.
That's unbelievable. You know, I have to have you come back to talk about this in the future.
But heart failure, pneumonia, things that reason could have responded to just reasonably meticulous and aggressive medical care. These people are just being consigned to die. And maybe they're taken care of by a hospitalist who didn't really know that they were in pretty good shape before their illness, and there was a good chance they could be restored to a reasonable state of health. I mean, they look really, really awful at the moment, and it's assumed, well, nothing can be done for them.
This is not the healthcare system that I want to be a part of. And Dr. Orion, how can our listeners reach you?
Our website is aapsonline.org. They can reach us by email from aaps at aapsonline.org.
I want to thank you so much for getting up at the crack of dawn to be with me today. It's always an honor and a pleasure to have you on.
Well, you're doing a great service, Dr. George. I'm so glad that your voice is reaching some people that the establishment media is just ignoring.
Well, thank you, and I wish you would come back again in the future.
Okay.
Thank you for joining me. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.